Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Software Crafts podcast. I'm your host, Joel, and today with us we have Julie Lerman. Julie is a Microsoft Regional Director, Doctor Captain, and a longtime Microsoft MVP, who now counts her years as a coder in decades. She makes her living as a coach and consultant to software teams around the world. You can find Julie presenting on Entity Framework, Domain-Driven Design, and other topics at user groups and conferences around the globe. Julie blogs at thedatafarm.com/blog, is the author of the highly acclaimed Programming Entity Framework books, the MSDN Magazine Data Points column, and the popular videos on pluralsight.com. Follow Julie on Twitter at Julie Lerman. Hi, Julie, and thanks for your time to be with us today.
Yeah, hello, Joel. I'm very happy to be joining you. Thank you.
Cool. Awesome. And today we don't bring a heuristic. Today we bring a pattern. And the pattern consists of two words: conserve familiarity. What is your experience with this pattern?
I had not known that it was a pattern, but it is inherent in my own way of working with my clients. I have a lot of, not many, but I have one client that I've been working with for 25 years. So I've written a lot of software for them over the years and been very involved in their company and have deep relationships with their employees who stay there for a long time. And I'm constantly using this pattern, not knowing that it was a pattern actually written in a book, object-oriented reengineering patterns that you introduced me to. But I'm always focused on making sure the end users aren't freaked out by changes in the application. One of the downsides of that is that we do have a lot of old software sitting there because of different reasons, right? But we are constantly evolving the software, and it's so important to not, like, you know, in terms of the pattern, the pattern literally says conserve familiarity warns you against introducing radical interface changes that may alienate users, right? So the actual experience of how the user interacts. And I don't think of that as just the UI, the user interface, but the user experience, the UX, right? Like, you know, not just what it looks like, but just, you know, what their expectations are, what happens. I'm literally working on something like that right now. As I'm waiting for the client to be ready to just, you know, really start changing. They have been evolving some of the software and replacing some of the software. But there's this, you know, there's this one piece of software that is still used by managers. They've actually created a web interface for their technicians to interact with. But this old application that I originally wrote for everybody is still used by managers. And they've asked for a change that impacts not just the front end, but the back end. And I decided that I cannot work with a code from that back end any longer. It's like 15 years old with technologies that don't even exist anymore. I had to work so hard to find the old code. In fact, luckily the old code interacts with the database and their stored procedure. So it was easy to figure out what the different API calls were doing. So what I'm doing is I'm replacing bit by bit those backend APIs that are written in this really old technology with new one, and then integrating with the application in a way that the users will never, ever know that anything's changed, except it makes it easier for myself and the people responsible for the software to maintain the software. So that's always, kind of first and foremost for me. Like, you know, eventually we will evolve the actual front end application that they're using, but we're just doing it slowly. There's one employee who works there. She's been there for about 30 years, and she's always challenged by, she still feels challenged by the computer. And she thinks anything that goes wrong is because she did something incorrectly. And I always think about her, and I always worry about making sure her experience isn't jarring or can create self-doubt. So there's this particular client is just such a perfect example of using this pattern. And again, it's just really funny because it's what I do. I didn't realize there was a pattern around it, but it makes a lot of sense, right? I've got these decades of experience, so I kind of naturally am working in this way, but encapsulating that kind of experience as patterns for newer developers who are just learning is just really a good practice, right? Like it's so helpful for them, so they don't have to learn the hard way about the things that maybe we learned the hard way.
Yeah, definitely. I can see that, especially because I did some of these migrations affecting the UI. So although I love the backend because it doesn't have a UI component, so we have different techniques, especially if we are in the cloud, we can spin up different services, different versions, and gradually moving functionality from left to right, top down. UIs are always trickier, right? So I was thinking, because in your language, you start by a customer with 25 years and deep relationships. And I just love that, because also you are have roots in the domain-driven design community. And now in the end, you give the example of this person that, have a unique relationship with computers.
The human,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in your experience, and you talk about user experience, how do we move users when we simply need to move beyond the command line to a more graphical interface, or we need to move from desktop interface to web-based, or we need to move from this big monitor to a cell phone, right?
Yeah.
How do we handle that?
Well, interestingly, in this particular case, there are more modern software that they're using. So we look at those, what they are also having experience with, and try to leverage that as well, like the familiarity with that, maybe the application that I'm focused on is very, very different, but maybe they're interacting with other more modern applications and seeing how that workflow is and trying to emulate some of that familiar workflow into, into not just workflow, but, how it literally looks and where things are and where the buttons are and just that interaction. So, so it's a different kind of familiarity, right? Maybe it's not a familiarity with the application that you're changing, but familiarity with other things that they're already interacting with.
Yeah, definitely. I see that. So I'm going to challenge you with an example that I had in my last job before I moved to consultancy. So I work in a Dutch e-com company that had a legacy system, built Oracle, Delphi on top of that. So everything was very list-based, which work when they start, because the products on the catalog was a few products. So my team work towards the buyers, so internal people of the company that make decisions. Will I buy 100 televisions or 200s because of the price, this type of stuff, which as the catalog grew becomes impossible. So we changed the UI for to cope with a new type of workflow. That is, what if we just tell them the products that need restocking? They don't need to go throughout this big list doing calculations to figure out the products that need restocking, but we're going to look to the value stream and their workflow and try to give a new piece of software that tells them, okay, you might optimize and just look to these products because these products need restocking. And because we don't know all details of the contracts, you need you, human, to make something. Did you also in your career have these type of optimizations, namely in these organizations with a long time that you start looking to the workflow and use different metaphors or?
Absolutely. So sometimes that's because the business themselves over time have evolved their workflow and not evolved the software to go along with the workflow. So actually modifying the software to match the existing workflow is something that's embraced by the end users because it makes more sense to them. You know, it may take a little learning curve, but the workflow makes sense moving from one to another. But there's also times when, you know, and this is kind of something that bubbles up a lot when working kind of on the within or around domain-driven design, when you're interacting with the domain experts. And the domain experts, you know, that can be end users, that can be customer service, right, et cetera. And sometimes just talking with them bubbles up these new perspectives that they might not have thought of, but by interacting with them and partnering with them and, you know, having these conversations, sometimes we come up with the new workflows and, you know, and you twist and turn and ask questions and just wait for those moments when they go, oh, all right. And, you know, and then you can introduce new patterns in that way also. But, you know, one thing that's really important, and I know that it's much more common now. When I started out programming and it didn't feel good to me, but, I know a lot of people working on systems still have this mindset that they know what's best for the users. And, you know, this is one of the reasons domain-driven design spoke to me so much. I was kind of late to the game, maybe 10 years after the book had been, Eric Evans' book had been published. And when I read the very beginning of it, it just like hit me in the soul, right? Because it was all about your relationships and building relationships and understanding people's needs and problems and working really closely with them. Cause that's how I'd always felt about how I worked with my clients. So leveraging a lot of that, I think, can lead towards, modernizing the actual user interface and the work and the UX and the workflow of applications in a way that, is going to be embraced by the users instead of upsetting them.
Yeah, I hope so. And thanks for sharing your experience. You pretty much went to my next question, that is talking about evolution, right? Because most of these things and this pattern, I also relate this pattern with evolution. We have a new business line. The company operates today in the Netherlands and tomorrow in Netherlands, France, and Belgium, for instance, right? It's about different
needs. Yeah, new problems introduced
exactly.
There.
Do you feel that the software community that we are in, this mindset of the users don't understand our software is shifting? Or we still have this static view of the software, this snapshot in time that it's done and now can be used? Or do you feel that we are getting new perspectives that we can leverage software because software can be very dynamic?
I think I think the positive and negative perspective on that comes from both sides. You know, as I had said with this particular client, and they're such a great example. I'm always going back to them and when I talking about them and my experience with them and their experience with me. You know, it is interesting to consider that how their workflow and their business has evolved over 25 years. The business has grown and grown and grown and grown. So they're doing all kinds of new things, but they also, even just growing introduces new problems, management problems and scheduling, coordination, all that kind of stuff. So they're, how they go about their business and how they think about how their data moves around has changed. And a lot of I wouldn't say that they're reluctant to change the software. However, there are reasons such as the expense of it, right? They've looked over the years for, this was all custom written software. They've looked over the years for software that's being produced now, like, you know, canned software that they can pre-created software. And even after 25 years, they still say nothing is as good as what you've written for us. So we still want to use it, even though, you know, there's a lot of issues. And some of that old software is emulating patterns that don't reflect what they're doing now, but they're so comfortable with how that works. There are some different factions within the company, of course, that feel differently about it, right? That want to change, know that the software will help. Like if they can evolve the software to match their workflow through the company, because it was really, when it was built, it was really compartmentalized, right? But now they want to have something that where information really flows. And it flows in a different way than the way it was designed originally when it was compartmentalized, because the company's grown so much. So I don't know if I've gone completely off kilter of what you were aiming at with a question, which was about, I think it was about the users, the clients, recognizing that the software can help them with their new workflow. So there are definitely people within the company who do. And then there's, you know, there's all kinds of reasons it's difficult sometimes to move that, budget, time, et cetera. Like this company has this very, very busy season and they cannot be distracted by dealing with testing software and having meetings about the software and things like that during that very, very busy season. So they get this small window where they can really, really hone in on it. And we've actually tried a couple of times. I wasn't involved, but there was, you know, there was a company that was brought in that I know had done really good work and it didn't go well. A lot of time was wasted. A lot of money was wasted. So they're a little gun shy, right? Everything's working. Yeah, so it's so complicated, so complicated. And it's not a company that has a software team, right? So they have to outsource. They have to find the right business. And I have always been independent. So like for their evolving their software, like I can make tweaks in the old software that they're still using. But, you know, the reason I've recommended other companies is you can't have just one person being responsible for this, right? Like
it's too risky.
Just one plane accident, because I fly a lot, right? One mistake on my bicycle in traffic, right? It's all gone.
Yeah, exactly.
So Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of reasons why it's hard to do it. So I have been in this case, I hate enabling them to continue using this old software, but on the other hand, I don't want it. You know, I want them to succeed in business. And so, you know, we talk about it. We now refer to everything as a Band-Aid, right? Like these little tweaks, because we really need to have new software. So I'm having fun right now with this, at least replacing these old web services with modern APIs. It's a little, you know, and there's a middle layer in the application. So I can have the middle layer, change the middle layer to interact with the new APIs. And yeah. then we'll, you know, so we got that working. And then the UI will just be the last thing to go. And then, you know, but it'll be fine until they're ready.
Yeah. Sounds like a sound plan. And I'm very happy to have these experience on the record. Because then I hope that inspires other people even to interact with you on social media to ask more about these patterns and these techniques to do so.
So you, I'm curious about your perspective on this, because it's very different than the actual work that I'm doing, which is me, one person working with this old client, right? Which is also different than when I'm coaching teams who are dealing with legacy software. That's a very different kind of thing. And I'm not doing the work, right? And we're talking about architecture and really thinking about new systems. But they're worrying about the UI and UX, but you're on a team and your team gets hired by other companies to take care of these problems.
Yes and no. Mainly now I serve as CTO. So I'm very connected to these problems where we are getting to invest the money and also the cultural ones, how to build a proper social technical system. But I'm mostly working with SaaS companies and companies that are digital by nature, which means mm-hmm. that they suffer what I call the iPad problem. So back in the day when iPads pop up, I work with central banks back in the day. Every person in central bank wants just to have this clean interface, and our software was very spreadsheet based, very numbers, right? So in the line of business where I am, I see a more flexibility on the type of digital companies that I work, where sometimes we just do big jumps. We try to invest a lot on UX, and now can we even, we want to jump in the way that users interact, because that is our unique selling point. Oh, this becomes so easy that I love this product.
Right, exactly. And it's about their experience, not making it so that they are happy.
Exactly.
And productive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So which poses the challenges, because the backend services, and that's why I also found my spot on domain-driven design community. If we have a sound boundaries and discuss what is inside and outside of a boundary, what this model doesn't do, that I keep saying that is very, very important, then can evolve. The product itself can evolve easily, because then we can start composing, or if we talk about domain-driven design, we can throw away bounded context and bring new bounded context in, right? And the landscape can evolve in a more organic way, as it should, right? We are, as engineers and as architects, we can be gardeners and trimming rather than enforcing these static structures. So this has been my experience, although last years I'm moving more into how we maintain a cohesive system. That is another set of challenges, which I love, but being mainly here. And I love the pressure of the market, right, on these competitive digital companies.
Did you say you love the pressure of the market?
Yes, with these digital companies.
So it keeps you fire lit under you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but you touch in the same thing, right? You touch about the relationships with, I deeply believe, if we develop the relationship, and also very inspired on domain-driven design, right, on the work of Alberto Brandolini, yeah. If we visualize, we can achieve great stuff. So my question to you, what is your go-to visualization collaboration / collaboration techniques to engage with groups, with teams?
For me, it has been event storming. I have loved doing that. You know, of course, the last year, things have been different. But I love having gone into work with clients that, you know, this is very different. Although I do want to, do have plans to do this with this 25-year client. But new clients that just wanted to, whether they're trying to reassess where they are in the marketplace or what they need to do to keep up with a marketplace. And just taking a look at their business workflow and, you know, how that relates to their systems, their software systems that exist, and, you know, just looking at all that. But visually, there's just nothing like it. You know, the big wall and the post-its, and it's visual for everybody, but it's also relationship building and teams that normally don't interact with each other, having conversations and these major aha moments about understanding how the decisions they make are impacting people downstream or the downstream team realizing why things are the way they are because of what somebody's doing upstream. Should I explain what event storming is?
Yes.
So event storming is something that was, I don't want to say invented, but it was just this inspiration of Alberto Brandolini. And he was working with clients. He was working with a business and everybody was just kind of talking at him and talking over each other. And he was really trying to understand how the business works so he could help them with the problem that they were asking him to solve and kind of help them figure out if they were aiming at the right problem, right? And he just kind of threw his hands up. And the next day he walked in the room with his big rolls of paper. He taped them up on the wall and piles of post-it notes and just said, okay, everybody just wants to talk all at once and tell me what's going on. Write the thing you want to tell me. Just write it down in this little sticky note. We're going to put it up on the wall. That's how they started, right? There was some rules. It's event storming. So it's a focus on what does really happen, like what maybe should happen, but an event, something that happened in the system, because everything stems from an action. There's actions and reactions. So the first very big approach is this, very chaotic, intentional with everybody just, you know, write whatever, there's no right and wrong. Just write down what's on your mind, but it has to be expressed as an event. So a thing that happened in the past tense, right? And so they just get it all out and then they start organizing it and looking for bounded contexts and having these just conversations. And the other thing is that the people in the room are a broad spectrum of the domain experts. So you get all these different perspectives and interactions. There's, you know, there's more to it, but it has been amazing to facilitate this and watch people experience this as well.
Yeah, I shared same experiences with you. I've run a couple of them and it's magical. So one of the first ones that I co-facilitate in the end with was this energy company. So a virtual, here in Netherlands, we have energy providers that don't own infrastructure. So we have this concept here. And they were having problems with speed of development. So we mapped all the business And the lady, the engineering manager, steps away and she sees the problem, because in the beginning, when they are acquiring customers, they call them customers. And in the end, when they are billing customers, they call them customers. The problem is that they although the sales team and financial team call customers, they have totally different behavior. One doesn't have a contract, the other one has. Company just create one piece of software to manage both. So was magical. Everyone was, and she just walks and says, I see the problem now.
Oh,
it's on both ends. And it's like,
that's the dream with event storming, right?
Exactly.
That somebody, and of course, you want to be the hero as the facilitator. You want to be the one to spot it. But whoever does, that really is the dream of somebody just going, oh my God, right? Like, I see the problem.
Exactly.
Right? Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Because we were on that phase that we start putting the emergent bounded context and then name the systems, and that pops up. Okay, they are different, but it's same system. Oops.
Okay. Yeah. And I like explaining that when I'm doing like, you know, real introduction to domain-driven design. I like to use context map that has just, I literally use that example of customer, how we call the customer all the way through, but it's very different. Like, okay, well, maybe over in financial, it's not really a customer, it's an account. Yep. Right? Now we're talking about account, and it's attached to a identity, a person who over here is a customer, so customer support, sales, like all these different areas of the business have totally different interactions and care about totally different behaviors with this, you know, as this kind of entity moves across, but it's not always the entity, right? Like just, I think that example of, you know, when we're in the financial end, it's not really the customer anymore. It's an account. Or even shipping, it's not really a customer. It's just an address that goes on a label, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And that goes to the engineering, right? And that goes to people looking, okay, data is flying around. Well, indeed, data is flying around, but what is the behavior, right? Do we need to centralize everything and have a canonical master data system? Or can we be clever and talk about data ownership? Who changes which part? And that is the construct of a customer, in this case. I usually use product because of my background on e-com. That is also a very interesting one. But these are the points that I do believe that we need more of these conversations, more of these relationships, to circle back to the beginning, to your language, to define the problem. Do you see that also over there in the US?
Because totally agree. Yes, absolutely.
Cool. So not with the risk that we are an echo chamber for our guests, for our listeners, because we are agreeing, but we came from the same communities. I would like to ask you one final question that are the resources related to this conversation, books, courses, blogs, videos, you know, podcasts that might help the audience to continue this learning journey.
I'm going to give you a crazy response. I think the most important resource is you. But yourself. Your experience and your instinct will drive so much, you know, just as an example, how I was saying conserve familiarity. I read this. I'm like, oh yeah, that's what I do. Right. And so often I think a lot of people don't trust their own experience and instinct. So I like to always tell people to, you know, respect that and bring that to the table. You know, I can't enough recommend domain-driven design books or podcasts and conferences. I guess I should give a shout out to the Domain Driven Design Fundamentals course, the second edition of it that Steve Smith and I just published on Pluralsight. And I am really looking forward to going back to this book that you pointed me to, where this conserved familiarity pattern lives, called Object-Oriented Reengineering Patterns, from 2013. I had not heard of it before. So I'm looking forward to taking a look at it.
Very cool. Very cool. Thanks. And I think that I will extract more heuristics from your first suggestion. And definitely I will make sure that the suggestions are on description of this episode.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you for all of your time to share the knowledge with us.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. I'm happy to have been invited to have this conversation and to re-meet you.
Yes, indeed. Okay, thanks very much. See you next time. You can follow us on Twitter at SCrowdsPodcast, visit our website softwarecraftspodcast.com, or visit our web page on LinkedIn.